What's up, Energy fam? Welcome back to another episode of Wicked Energy with JG, the place where energy, economics, and innovation converge. I'm your host, Justin Gauthier, coming to you live from the vibrant city of Houston, Texas. As someone who spent years immersed in the oilfield service sector and focusing on energy economics and drilling operations, each week we dive into the heart of the energy sector, exploring its trends, challenges, and the future of energy in our lives. But today, I'm reaching out to you, my valued listeners, with a special opportunity. Wicked Energy is looking for partners who share a passion for energy, innovation, and impact. We're on the hunt for sponsors who want to connect with a dedicated audience of energy enthusiasts, professionals, and those keen on understanding the complex world of energy economics. By sponsoring, you'll not only support our mission to be the voice of energy, but also gain access to a platform where your brand can shine. Whether you are in the energy sector, finance, technology, or any field that resonates with the energy and innovation space, we believe your message deserves to be heard. If you're interested in exploring this opportunity and aligning your brand with a podcast that's all about making an impact, I'd love to start the conversation. Reach out to me at the link below or hit me up on LinkedIn. Together, we can fuel conversations that matter and leave a legacy that resonates for our listeners and beyond. Thank you for tuning in. Now, let's jump into the show.
Perfect. Let's go here. All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. I'm here with Justin Carlson, CCO and founder of East Daily Capital Advisors. Justin, it's an absolute pleasure. We kind of hit the ground running. I wish we would have hit record already, but we got going in all kinds of different directions. But welcome to the show. Yeah, it's not Justin on Justin for the first time, but it's I always love having a Justin on the call here. Man, where are you visiting from today? First of all, you got a cool background. For those who aren't watching, I'm going to describe it because you look like a busy man.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm in Denver. I'm actually in Littleton. If those of you felt familiar with Denver, sort of the west side of the Denver metro area, it is a cold day as we've had that first blast of cold come through that everybody's talking about for this weekend. Yeah. But yeah, you saw all this stuff on the wall. It's actually my dad's 1964 Bianchi on the wall. He wanted to be an Olympic biker when he was 17. So that survived hanging in the garage of my mom's house and so restored and put on the wall, and even got a couple of warrants there from some bike shows I went to, which was pretty cool. But
I don't know much about the bike world aside from my Mongoose BMX bike I used to have back in the day, but is that like a very unique bike, or what's the story with that kind of bike?
Oh, so my dad bought this bike. It was the best bike you could buy in 1964. It was, made in Italy. It was handmade in Italy, mind you. So like for those of you who are, a little mechanically minded, like the holes, like for screws and whatnot, were drilled by hand. So some of them are like cockeyed and like not exactly, it's not a machine in there. And, we just discovered all this as we were rebuilding it. And he bought that with his paper route money. And that's what he spent, basically all his money on was that bike there. And pretty cool heirloom to have from my dad that, gets to, and I've ridden it too, by the way. It's not just a fancy thing on the wall. I did a 100-mile race in New Mexico on it. So the thing rides. Yeah, it's good. Thing is made of all aluminum, it's a chrome frame painted green, which is just amazing. Like who makes an entire frame out of chrome? Well, I guess in 1964, we made quarters out of silver and frames out of chrome. You know what I mean? Like it's cool.
How far have we come? Hey, man, that is such a, and I love how you have it on your wall behind your computer because it's obviously a talking point. I'm assuming I'm not the first guy who's asked about it. Wow. So you did a 100-mile race on that thing?
Yeah. I rode around Denver a couple times. They've like a 60-mile route around Denver that you can take. And I've done that a couple times on the bike. So it's fun, right? Oh, for those of you that are bikers, they probably understand old steel's kind of fun because it's, everything today is made of carbon fiber, so if there's like a crack in the sidewalk, you feel it on these old steel bikes. Like they don't feel that kind of stuff. They're just built different, right? So they are the natural shock absorber of the bike itself. So
no kidding. Cool. What a neat story. And so you're obviously, your old man was a biker. Did he ever make it to the Olympics?
Well, that's the funny thing. No, he didn't. He definitely wanted to. And it's a funny thing that, you know, my dad died actually the same year we started East Daily, but he never rode in my lifetime. Like, I never saw him ride. So this is one of those sort of like, hey, Dad, you hung this up in the garage and you never, like, you know, for those of you with kids, and I don't need to get too sentimental here, but like, share your hobbies, share your loves with your kids, because, you know, my dad didn't share that with me, and I had to find it out later. Like, wow. And I've got, you know, pictures that there's a picture on the wall back there of him standing next to the bike. And there's, you know, my dad never threw anything away. My mom found a box of his old jerseys, and they're like these heavy wool, wool jerseys. And you're like, now today everything's made of oil now. So it's like all thin and like, breathable, and that stuff is like, it's thick and heavy. I'm like, how did you ride with this?
But no kidding,
it's
no,
pretty cool stuff.
That is, man. But I can appreciate you sharing that. I mean, as a father, I've got an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old. You know, some of the hobbies, like, I would say I do try and share some of the hobbies with them. There's still some young, but
yeah.
I mean, for yourself, like, what? I mean, sounds like you have kids, yeah.
Yeah, I have a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old.
Okay.
So we, you know, and I fish. So fortunately, my 11-year-old loves fishing. I should probably do more of it, but he's not a bad fly fisherman. So we just need to get him out more, take the time and separate out. So, but it's good. Like, you know, biking, I'm trying to get him to want to do the, maybe not the biking stuff, I run too. So like, he can bike, I can run, like whatever. I'm just trying to get him out there to do that stuff. But you know how hard it is these days to get your kids away from screens. It's like, well, Dad, I'm playing online with my friend in Tulsa. And I'm like, okay, well, right, I'm going to go for a run. Maybe next time. Catch you next time.
Man, I get it. That could be a whole nother topic of conversation. Yeah. But, you know, it's we found, at least every family's different, but we've been able to find a healthy balance of the whole screen time thing. And my daughter, she's 9 or 8, sorry, but she's big into softball, and she wanted to get stronger, and cause she's a little smaller. And so I've managed to bring her to, I'm part owner in a gym here in Katy, but I managed to bring her to the gym on Sunday mornings. And so getting to just do little workouts with her, cause that's my sort of vocation is health and fitness. And so, but yeah, we kind of get to do our little workout thing together, but it's tough. Like, my son, he's like me. I guess my mom was telling me the other day that she had bought me a Nintendo when I was like 4 years old, and it took everything in her power to peel me away from that thing.
Yeah.
So my son's the same way. My daughter's kind of take it or leave it, but yeah, it's, again, that's a whole nother topic of conversation, but
yeah, right. Start a different podcast.
Yeah. No kidding. How to parent kids who all they want to do is play on their iPads. Real quick though, too, you've got an absolute library behind you too. I'm curious, if you were to gift a book out of that library you got behind you, just one, what would that be? What's the most impactful book you got there?
Oh goodness. That's a tough question, because there's so many different topics that you could you could dig in on. I would say, a lot of those books are, you know, leadership and business stuff and things like that. And I really geek out on that stuff. So here's one that I'm not all the way through it. So it's I hesitate to advocate it yet, but I geek out on this stuff. So I really like it, but it's called Super Thinking. It's a good book. And it's about mental models that you can sort of store in your head to think about problems differently. Like, and we know a lot of them, or I bet you if you started reading the book, you'd be like, oh, I know a bunch of these, but then there's so many more you don't know about, like, mental models of ways to think about the world and simplified problems so that you can put it in perspective. So that's the one I'm on now, and I really like it. I also really enjoy the Patrick Lencioni stuff. For those of you familiar, he's like a business psychologist. He runs the Table Group. Which is a consulting company, but I really enjoy his sort of logic around leadership and running organizations and stuff. So he's got a whole host of, you know, business books and leadership books and things like that. They're easy to read. told as a fable, so they're not, you know, super dry, like technical stuff. They're more like storylines, which I which I appreciate that he took that angle. So it's cool stuff.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. I'm sure a lot of people listening are into that too. I mean, I am. I've listened. Anytime I read, it's like, how can I improve my, you know, just like my personal development, my leadership, career, business. And so it's, yeah, oftentimes I find they follow a similar pattern, but there are some where it's like, wow, this is something I've not heard before, the perspective, or again, their experience that they could share that really like sinks and hits home. But look at that, already some nuggets coming out. So those two books, folks, if you haven't looked at them, or obviously the one and then the other author there, check them out. So shifting gears a little bit there, Justin, I want to ask you, how is 2024 treating you so far? And mainly, did anything surprise you coming out of 2023 that kind of has made you sort of reevaluate things going into 2024? And let's just talk macro level energy. I mean, is everything kind of clicking along like you thought, or is anything different? Like what's kind of, where's your head at right now?
Yeah, I don't know that anything's necessarily different. I mean, some of the big themes, you know, we did a big, you know, big annual report, and so I'm sort of coming off the heels of that sort of report going, okay, this is where we have our line in the sand, and we're going to track that stuff throughout the year and see how it went. I guess one of the things, you know, that we had talked about in the report was like, we expect a lot of M&A to continue in the midstream space specifically. Mm-hmm. I haven't followed the E&P space as much, but I know that a lot of folks, or it felt like a lot of the stuff I was hearing was, hey, M&A is going to slow down in the E&P space, but it hasn't, and accelerated, which makes sense now that I've like put some brain cells to it and actually thought about it. So maybe that's it's not a surpriser. Like it's one of those things where, you know, once it happens, you're like, ah, duh. Okay. Well, I should have thought more deeply about that one. Yeah. But, it's interesting to see the consolidation. Obviously, we just had Southwestern and Chesapeake come out with their, you know, big merger discussion and conclusion. And we'll, you know, obviously we'll see how that all plays out in the final throes of things. But definitely that consolidation in the industry is a thing that, you know, we're watching, because it changes the analytic dynamics, or can, when you've got a smaller number of players having a bigger influence on overall dynamics. So that's, I guess, one thing I look at.
Yeah, no, and I want to dive into that. There's a piece of in your guys' report that you do talk about that, which I want to dive into. But I mean, kind of backing up a little bit, and for the audience wondering, I came across Justin on LinkedIn. I don't know if it was East Daily that had put something out, but I somehow clicked around and found you, and then found your guys' report called The Dirty Little Secrets, which again, I think is from a marketing perspective was great, because it certainly caught my attention. And so I'm curious, can you kind of describe what that report is and then how you came to calling it Dirty Little Secrets?
Yeah, that's it. So Dirty Little Secrets is our annual report. We've been running it for about 8 years. In the beginning, it was this book. It was like 300 pages, and we, you know, labored intensely over this thing. But the genesis of it really was, okay, we've got all this knowledge to share. We're uncovering all of this stuff. And East Daily, just as by way of background a bit, is we focus on both the commercial as well as the fundamental components of the energy sector, particularly in midstream. We like to connect the dots. We call it, you know, connecting the molecules to the money, meaning, you know, the fundamental molecules all the way through how people make money from them. It's and so we had all this knowledge. And what's interesting when you do that is you start to uncover things. So when you're connecting, like, let's say the fundamental analytics of like supply and demand to financially how somebody makes their money, and you do that over and over again, what happens is when you're pairing these data sets, let's say publicly available data sets together, you inherently solve through a balanced equation, you know, unknown things. So, you know, just it's algebra, right? So you got A plus B plus C equals D. Well, you know D because it's the, you know, let's say the finances that they report in their K's and Q's. You know A and B because let's say it's publicly available. All of a sudden, you've got this C element. And you're like, oh, well, now I know that. I could just do math. And that was the dirty little secret, is you could just do math and find things that people weren't finding. Wow. And so, you know, 8 years ago when we were thinking about this report, I'm like, it's like a It's like a dirty little secret. There's all this free data out there that if you put it together in the right way, you find things that you couldn't discover. It's this dirty little secret. And for I joked about on the podcast or on the, sorry, in the webinar that we did, that, you know, the first 3 years were the cover of Dirty Little Secrets was this satin sheet. You know, it's like a dirty little secret.
Yeah.
And there is an actual person under those sheets. I just covered that person.
No way.
Yeah, so it's sort of like, that's the dirty little secret behind the report, is there is a person under there somewhere.
No way.
You just don't know. Yeah, it's you wouldn't find him under there, but you'd have to go back to the original images and dissect them. But yeah, that's the genesis of the report, is we go through the fundamental aspects of crude, natural gas and NGLs, and then connect that all through the financial expectations for many of the midstream companies. And obviously the fun part about midstream is it's the connection between upstream and downstream. So it forces you to understand where are power markets going, where are export markets going, and then upstream, what are producers doing, what is IP rates, production curves. Like, you have to do all of that. So it's a full cycle.
There's a lot to unpack there. And so I want to kind of zoom out and give you an opportunity to tell the origin story of East Daily, because this, you know, you've been in business for a while, but obviously you had a career before that. And then kind of your mission and how it's evolved over the years.
Well, yeah, no, I appreciate that. The origin story was, I had come from a company called Ventech Energy. We were, focused primarily on scraping pipeline flow data and putting those together in models. So we would take all that nomination data from the gas grid and put it together into supply demand models, and really founded some of the first, really holistic ways to use that flow data to understand the market. Well, fast forward, we were bought by Platts and became a part of the Platts S&P family.
Okay.
And after about 3 years there, in 2014, Boardwalk Pipeline Partners had cut their distribution, and the stock had, I think, cratered in half that year. And my partner and I looked at that and were like, well, this is interesting. Like, well, I think we could have predicted that. Like, why didn't the smart guys in Wall Street understand that this company was at risk from a revenue standpoint based on where their assets are? And so I didn't even know really what EBITDA was. I mean, I knew what it was, but I probably said it wrong. I'm probably still saying it wrong. I didn't know much about finance. I'm a mechanical engineer by background, so finance wasn't my gig necessarily. But what we said is, let's see if we can't hire a financial analyst to just sort of take our fundamental data, dissect this company at the most granular level possible, and see if we could have predicted it. Now, it turns out we were wrong in what we thought was the cause of them cutting their distribution, but we were right in the fact that if you put all that very granular data together, asset by asset, in the case of many pipelines, you could do it contract by contract, risk each one, you could actually understand why they had to cut their distribution, or violate their debt covenants, or not grow. And as you can remember back in 2014, not growing was not an option. You didn't get that option back then. Obviously no one messes with the guys that give you debt, because that's a big no-no. You're not gonna grow either if you can't get debt. So the only logical solution was to cut the distribution, and we felt like you could have seen that about 2 years ahead of when they actually did it. So that was sort of the genesis of East Daily, was, hey, let's go and put all these data sets together and really from the ground up build these financial models. And then on the back side of that, we started, you have to develop the fundamental models that support that, the supply demand, what's the basin doing? How's the whole market interacting? How are pipes going to fill? How are G&P plants going to fill? We have another fun story about, somebody had a client had come to us and asked us about a new plant, and, they had done a multiple valuation of how much EBITDA that plant was going to generate. And they came to us and said, so it's a $200 million plant. We think it's about a 10x multiple. It'll probably generate about $20 million EBITDA a year. And we said, well, yeah, but they don't have any rigs back there. So I don't know how they're going to generate $20 million if they've got no volume going through their new plant. So sort of, not that the financial analyst in this case was wrong. They were 100% right. That is what the company had planned to do, but the market had changed on them. And so then now they had a plant that wasn't going to really do anything until they got more rigs back there, or they made other decisions. Let's say shut down another plant and moved all the volumes over to their new, more efficient plant. You know, those are all operational decisions that these companies can make to mitigate, you know, let's say a financial decision that turns on its head, turns in your face.
Yeah. No just kidding.
Just like any of us small business owners do, right? You make a bad decision and you're like, all right, well, I'm going to make lemonade out of these lemons because this is another good one.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. And so when you guys got started, has it kind of evolved on what you guys offer? Have you expanded? Like, talk about a little bit of the growth that you've had over the years.
It has expanded a ton. As you might recall, 2014 was like the first, or that we started the business in October 2014, and then all of a sudden crude oil markets cratered in 2015, and then they cratered again in 2016. So we launched it exactly, I don't know if it was the right time or the wrong time, but I would say that there was volatility generally, when things are up and to the right, and everybody knows, you can bet on anything and it works. Those generally aren't the good markets for analytics companies to come into because everybody's a genius, right? Oh, I bet on this, I'm the best stock trader in the world. And you're like, yeah, but everything's going up, man. So I don't know that you are.
Yeah.
But we grew a ton into that volatility where, we had something to offer, particularly Wall Street at that point in early in our phases where we just knew a lot about these assets. And we, often like to say we take the trash out, meaning we go out and dig into all these details, and then we set that detail up and that story for our clients to say, hey, here's the facts. Let's not argue about these. These are facts. This is data that we have. These are facts. And here's how we modeled it going forward. And, we'll let you make the financial decision, whether this is a buy or a sell or whatever, the valuation portion of it. But we've got you all the facts. And we can also argue about the future because the future is unknown. But let's get the facts on the table and then have a discussion. And so we grew a lot through the financial space, but subsequently have now spent a lot of time with midstream companies and E&Ps and others in the industry because, you've got all the facts on their competitors. You got detailed analysis of, a basin or a region or demand centers, or you can put some logic together around how just the market will evolve from a network perspective. And so there's just a lot of fun stuff that you can start to unearth. You just gotta ask questions, right? It's the ask a question and find an answer through data and then logic, really.
Yeah. So when you're looking at, like, I'm curious about your guys' kind of unique approach. You publish a lot of good content. You guys are active on LinkedIn, market intelligence type stuff, but who is your typical primary, I don't know if I'd be your primary target, because I find it just more kind of good high level for my job and understanding, from what the free stuff that you guys put out is super valuable for me, and I take that and then kind of go forward with my sort of day. But who would you say are the people using, because you guys have multiple services which I want to get into, but who's your target audience typically?
Yeah, the audience is the analytics group within a midstream company, the portfolio managers or analysts within a finance company, decision makers, ultimately, the guys that have to make, the investment decision on, let's say, capacity to take out on different pipelines or even infrastructure to build. We do quite a bit of due diligence too on assets because, what's fun about due diligence, and we have a consulting group, so we have a product side and we have a consulting side. But what's fun about due diligence is sort of you walk in and somebody gives you a data room and they say, hey, here's a data room. And you go, well, that's nice and all, but I want to see what's not in the data room. Where's that? And you're like, well, that's in our data sets, right? It's finding all that stuff that's not in the data room because, let's be fair, most of the time you only put good things in the data room. You don't put bad things in the data room. So, it's finding that stuff, that's fun. That's the dirty little secrets, right? Those are the fun things to find. So we get a lot of, let's say private equity or even due diligence for for, you know, industry acquisitions where it's a, you know, midstream company picking up another asset saying, okay, I want an outside view of this. I don't just want, you know, we all know the phrase, you know, when you get sort of groupthink, right? You don't want any groupthink. Everyone thinks it's great, but no one's willing to say, nah, this isn't good.
Right.
Let's one second look at this. So we get some of that too. That's most of our client base is those people that, honestly, it's people that have to make decisions every day in the energy industry, try to decide, are we building or buying or, you know, investing in the right things or not?
Yeah. Yeah. Have you over like, say, since, say, 2015, 16, when we hit that, you know, big downturn, has your sort of target changed? Like, has your customer base changed, not necessarily on like types of companies, but I guess what I'm asking is like, have you had to kind of market differently for, say, like a younger generation or a generation that kind of looks at utilizing your types of tools differently? Like, talk a little bit about your marketing and approach on like communicating what you guys do to your potential customers. So I'm curious. Well,
I mean, the marketing approach is not hard. It's relatively simple. You tell a good story about the market. And then, you know, once you tell a good story, then people, I want our customers to always understand the story because then they can make decisions for themselves. Mm-hmm. So I want to tell that story. It brings people in saying, hey, you have an interesting perspective. Maybe it's the same. Maybe it's different, but you're willing to tell a story about it. You're willing to not, there's no black boxes here, right? I'm not hiding anything. So if you want to see the data, you know, I want to make that available to people to say, hey, here's the data that tells me this is what the answer is going to be. I will say that, you know, that sort of brand, it's why we're active on LinkedIn. It's, you know, why I enjoy telling our story on, you know, podcasts like yours is because people don't read email anymore. Like nobody wants to go and get marketed. I don't want to get marketed to by an email, right? So I don't, you know, for me, the best way to do that is to get out, tell your story. You know, as much as my friends like to, you know, the younger generation like to talk about, you know, remote work and virtual, you know, virtual work and whatnot and virtual meetings. And I'm like, listen, I'm all for it. I love it. But there's still something very powerful about one-on-one in an office, telling a story, drawing on a whiteboard. You know, there's just something very powerful about that human connection that I think is, and I don't think I'm that old. So at least if I not like to believe I'm not at all, but there's something very fun and powerful. And I'm in my, you know, I'm in my happy zone when I'm at a whiteboard with a bunch of, you know, smart people that all have different ideas. And we got to put all those pieces together on a whiteboard and say, okay, this is what it means.
Yeah.
It's fun stuff.
No, I agree. I mean, I was, and again, it's, I guess it depends on your role. And then there's some people that, you know, like I have one, a relative who loves working from home, like doesn't ever want to go back to an office, like just likes being in his little box and just does his job. And at the end of the day, he's done. And I just it's like nails on a chalkboard for me. Like I like to be around people and, you know, some of the best meetings and things that have happened and some of the greatest ideas have come from like, me and another guy is bullshitting here at the office and all of a sudden someone else comes in and next thing you know, like you're kind of in the zone talking about things and, you know, sparks are flying and here you go. Like, it's just, you get it, you write things down and hopefully there's some follow through because there's always a lot of good ideas, but then a lot of people don't want to take the bull by the horns. But, but to your point, like at the end of the day, I think when we look at oil and gas, it's imperative to build a good culture. And I think that's changed over the years. And again, at the end of the day, it's hard to build culture on Zoom. I don't believe you can. And it's so, but anyway, it's an interesting topic.
Well, yeah. And not to sidetrack too much, but I can't help but not do this because, you know, just with respect to culture, and I don't know what your audience is. We never really talk about that. Like, do you have a lot of younger folks? You know, do you have a lot of mid-life sort of folks, whatever?
I would say age 30s and 40s is what the data says.
Okay, well, let's see if we can get you some. I would love to get you some younger folks because honestly, the reality is like the best ideas I've ever gotten come from people that either are brand new to the space or are brand new even out of college because they ask the questions that I have you know, I have overlooked for years, right? Meaning I think I know something, and then they ask a dumb question and I'm like, well, huh, I haven't looked at that in years, and that ought to be something we look at again. And all of a sudden it's there, dog writing on the wall, like, oh my God, I missed it because I had overlooked it because I thought I knew it, right? And, yeah. And that's the really cool stuff. And so I don't, again, I'd encourage anybody listening to this podcast, don't forsake your idea or your experience or whatever, because the honest to God truth is you could have the most valuable idea in the world and you're hiding it because you're insecure about it or whatever, but that idea could be the game changer to make something super powerful.
No, happen. I agree. It's that is an, I love that because, you know, for, I love when we have interns come in because I grill them about like, how can we make this company different? What are you doing anything in your role that like, would you do this different? Or like, what's like some idea that you have for us? And they kind of look at me like me, like, you think I have an idea? I'm like, yes, please. Cause we all have, like, we're so stuck in our ways, you know, for, to some degree. And I think to your point is like, if you have a degree of open-mindedness and you at least consider it, cause, but I think it's kind of like systemic, you know, oil and gas. Like I started off on a drilling rig and I was told from day one, you don't talk, you get paid from the neck down. We don't pay you to think. We don't pay you to talk. We get, you get paid. Yeah, no. And I was like, yes, sir. Like, I'm just going to do my job and I am not going to suggest anything because, you know, I would get verbally undressed by every other rig hand on the rig. And so, you know, it was hard to break out of that. And fortunately I'm hard headed. And so I'd still like, I didn't mind being laughed at or being told like, shut up, like that's a dumb idea. But the reality is like in oil and gas, that's kind of the old school way of doing things. It's just like, you don't question me. We're going to do this because we've always done it. And if, you know, if you're going to put up any, if you're going to get in the way of what we're trying to do, then, you know, you're not worth having. And so, but I think that's changing. You know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of companies are embracing sort of meritocracy and, you know, allowing people to have a voice. And that's one thing at the company I'm at, we're an oil field service company, fairly large. And you know, we embrace people's opinions, you know, and it's like, or ideas, cause to your point, like a lot of the best ideas come from people who don't have any biases and they don't know any better. And it's like, it'd be like, oh, actually that, you know, it sounds kind of odd, but let's think about this in a way that there might be some validity here to, you know, how we can work off of this idea. And I think that's just how we're going to evolve, you know, and hopefully attract more talent because we're going to need it.
Yeah, no, we're definitely going to need it as an industry. And I do think even when we talk to the younger folks and, you know, I'm certainly not going to get preachy here for the folks that are, you know, been in this industry for a while, but, you know, invite those people in and say, hey, I want your ideas because they could really help you and help the company and B, to your point, we've got to attract more people in this industry. And I think this generation and well, anybody wants a voice, right? We all want a voice. So
of course
to be heard. So
yeah, no, it's a fascinating topic. Pivoting back to sort of energy markets and stuff like that. I'm curious from, and you guys published it. So I encourage all the readers to, and I'll put the link in the show notes to look up Dirty Little Secrets. You guys are actually going to be down in Houston in a couple weeks. Can you kind of share what that's about? Because it kind of stems from the Dirty Little Secrets road show. And that it's the road show, right? Is what you guys are doing?
Yeah. We're doing a little road show. We're going to go down. We're going to have a happy hour, you know, and have a bunch of people out, share some thought leadership. It's not going to be a repeat of the, you know, of the webinar per se. People can go back and look at that. I probably will share a couple of the same slides, but really geared towards all the questions we've gotten since. Then, hey, what's this and what's that? And I want to invite, you know, the analysts that, you know, contributed so much to making the report and every year contributed time to making the report happen. While the people, you know, I won't call them behind the scenes because they'll definitely be right on stage, but they're the, you know, they're in front of the presentation standpoint, Dirty Little Secrets. They were behind the scenes, you know, I was just a talking head, so to speak. But, you know, we're going to get them in front, answer questions. They're the guys and gals that are in the details, you know, digging through the data. And so really more of an interactive sort of happy hour presentation ask where I'll get a lot of people involved. And then, you know, we're in Houston. I say it's a road show because we're, you know, I wish we should have rented a big van, you know, really did something like that. That would have been cool. But we, you know, we're going to go around and visit people in their offices. You know, not everyone can make it to a happy hour, or alternatively, like, it's fun to go into people's offices and get their entire team, you know, there, and then we can banter back and forth. Cause honestly, that's the fun stuff, right? Like,
yeah,
when you get there, I don't want to just selling reports and selling, you know, services is great, but the real fun is interacting with your clients, helping them solve problems, giving them ideas that they haven't thought of, cause you're just dumb enough to, you know, ask that dumb question because you don't work in their office, or, you know, like, that's the fun stuff. So we'll be going around and roadshowing around to different offices of both clients and prospects. So if there's a, you know, if you watch that Dirty Little Secrets thing and there's something that sparks your, you know, sparks something for you, we'd love to come by and just introduce ourselves and have a market conversation. And then, you know, if you from that see something that we can help with or might be able to help with, then we can talk about that. But
yeah,
let's just have a fun conversation.
I think that's great, man. I love how you guys are taking it on the road and really just being flexible, not having a strict agenda, but hopefully, you know, you get folks reaching out and you can kind of either divide and conquer or as a team go, like you said, to different offices and stuff like that. It's funny you mentioned having a van that, yeah, you could wrap it and like some, you know, some interesting artwork or whatever, and just you guys bomb down in a van and stop at different places. And that'd be hilarious. And yeah, I don't know, like, it'd be, even if you, Haley, if you like did a video blog, you know what I mean? Like, if you
like
film the entire thing and then you could create content around it, and then use it for marketing, right? Like, here, and then, you know, you could make a cool video and then you could splice it up in like different sort of segments of like, oh, we were over here and we talked about NGLs, and then over here we talked about like pipeline capacity, and you know, you could do all kinds of cool stuff with that.
Oh man, now you're giving me some ideas. We're actually renting, this is the first time we're going to try this, but we have enough people going down there. We're doing a VRBO, renting a house, you know, you know, just rather than individual hotel rooms. So
I love
there's
that
some
idea.
Sort of like, you know, you remember back to the MTV days and
like, man, that's great. That's
this could get a real world real quick.
Oh man, this could be a thing. That's like, cause like there's folks out there, like, you know, I'm obviously familiar with like influencers and stuff. They would all rent a house and like film a week's worth of content in there, and then they would have it for forever. Like, you could literally set up a little table with microphones. You could invite people in to do like 5-minute market segments, like, you know, what industry are you in and what are you seeing and what trends that, and man, you could do all that. You could maximize every second of you being down here, man. I can promise you. So
well, the cool thing is, I mean, it's, you're maximizing is one thing, but it just be fun. You know what I mean? That's the whole point of all this stuff, is you want to do work because it's fun, not because it's like work, right? Like,
yeah.
Fun stuff.
I agree, man. No, and it sounds like you do, man. I can appreciate the energy that you're giving here, and I would imagine the rest of the whole team over there is probably similar. I do want to, you know, selfishly, I love diving into market stuff, and so I do want to kind of ask you a few things, because again, I'm sure the audience is interesting to hear. I look a lot of about crude oil, natural gas, because at the end of the day, my career, we live and die by rig count. But what I am interested in more so and to learn about is the NGL market. I've been kind of hearing some more buzz around it. And then obviously in your guys' report, you talk about crude oil, natural gas, you know, the midstream stuff, and you also talk about NGLs. And so could you kind of give an overview of the current state of the NGL market and kind of what your guys' outlook is into 2024?
Yeah, well, I mean, the NGL market is, it's awesome, right? You think about a market from a growth standpoint that, you know, NGLs were a byproduct, right? Like, this is something that people, like, was an afterthought. And now it's not a byproduct. It is core to many business lines and companies and their growth strategies, right? And so from a growth standpoint, most of the NGLs come from the Permian. They're coming from West Texas. Obviously, we've got a decent amount coming from the Bakken as well. And the Anadarko collects some. And we get our Marcellus stuff coming from the Northeast down, you know, ATEX, which is, you know, movement. Everything's going to, you know, one central place, the, you know, the mothership in Mont Belvieu, or most of it's going to Mont Belvieu to be fractionated and, you know, broken into its, you know, parts and put out into the chemical space or exported or whatever. But that market's grown. It's amazing to look at, let's say, propane markets and how much the, you know, are, you know, 70% of the demand for propane is now exports, right? That is a massive shift from where it was, you know, 10 years ago, it was like 30%. And now it's 70%. It's a massive shift. Ethane, you know, went from, let's say, 2, 3, 4%, you know, back in that same period of 2014 when we started East Daily, you know, to now it's 20%. So these are markets that are you know, growing, demand markets that are growing very fast. We're building export terminals. The market's really consolidated there. So when you think of the big players on the midstream side, it's, you know, it's Energy Transfer, it's Targa, and then it's Enterprise. I mean, those three alone from, let's say, the Permian, they just give you some, at least some perspective. So there are like 125-esque plants, like processing plants in the Permian, owned by 25 different, let's say, entities, companies.
Okay.
Those three companies, ET, EPD, and Targa, right now own over 50% of the capacity down there. So it's really dominated by those three players, or has become dominated, and it's through acquisitions. We've talked about M&A, you know, and the continued transition of M&A, but, you know, private companies like Navitas, Lucid, which you guys, you know, I'm sure a lot of the folks on the podcast might be familiar with. You know, these are companies that were picked up by Targa and EPD, and in those acquisitions, they've also, you know, built new pipes, right? So we've got those three companies own 60% of the pipes leaving the Permian.
Wow.
So, and that's a hugely overbuilt market, meaning they built all those pipes. And really, that's what's interesting about that is sort of I call it the knife fight. I don't know that those companies maybe necessarily appreciate it, but it's like, we've got this knife fight where we got all the capacity is out there, and now all of these companies are fighting for the different barrels coming out of those processing plants and how much they can gather. And it's going to make it really hard for the non top three to operate when you've got three that are really controlling that whole value chain of G&P all the way through pipeline to the fractionators and, you know, in Mont Belvieu, where, you know, again, those same three own most of the fractionation capacity too. So it's really a consolidated market. That's getting very interesting and very tied to, as I talked about before, exports and global markets and how those move. So it's going to be interesting to watch. We're probably going to see quite a bit of pressure on, you know, on prices in those markets, just because of, you know, you're just going to have a dearth of NGLs coming out, and we're still waiting on a bit of growth on the demand side.
Gotcha. Where do you see, like, what would you think would drive growth on the demand side?
Well, I mean, you're talking PDH units in China. You're talking about, you know, it's these foreign markets. That's the problem. We don't have enough growth on the U.S. side to support it. And that's the case for gas. It's the case for crude. Like, everything's going overseas. So we are very much a major market player now. You know, we're already one of the largest exporters of natural gas. Like, you know, obviously we know where that's come from in the last decade, like from imports to exports. Like it was not only export, but like, you know, top exporter, right? It's a big shift. So, you know, everything, I think that's the biggest analytic shift that is, you know, has occurred, as obviously in the energy industry as a whole, but I would put that as, you know, probably top on the biggest analytic shifts and market shifts, is just our dependency on exports to drive demand. And then what volatility that can potentially create, which was a big theme of the report, was volatility. You know, and where our market's so tightly wound around what happens in other markets now, and not just, you know, when I entered the space, it was like natural gas in particular. It's like everything all depended on the weather in New York and stuff. And that still matters. Don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of export capacity that and deliverability that matters these days.
Yeah. So talk about the volatility that you mentioned in your report. I mean, obviously we have, well, there was Russia, Ukraine, but then there's the you know, the Red Sea and the turmoil over there. How would you say a lot of that, like, how does that impact what you're doing, and how do you typically think about things differently so that you can still deliver on some again, your models or your analytics can accurately reflect what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, the volatility is really around the tightness in the market. So if you go back, like, I'll talk about gas, for instance. We were in this period where all of the demand we had was supplied by Permian. And Permian is an oil play. It's not a gas play. So it was relatively inelastic towards, you know, what gas prices did, which obviously, as everybody sort of knows, it drove gas prices down, but it also drove volatility down. If there was any fluctuation in demand, let's say, there was just this dearth of gas and the storage coffers were full and, you know, everything was not volatile. Well, then we got to COVID, right? And oil prices crashed. The growth outlook for the Permian and all this, you know, associated gas and dumping on the market just sort of disappeared. And we had a ton of volatility start to enter the market in 21, 22, as you think about the land fluctuations, where's demand coming back? When are we shipping, you know, boats overseas? What power going to do? All of a sudden power enters the sector and we are, you know, hitting records every single year on power demand and power consumption in the gas sector, at least. So it's that tightness that creates that volatility, because there's, if you think about it today, we're about to add, you know, we're already at, you know, 12 to 14 BCF per day of LNG demand. And then we're going to add, you know, Golden Pass and Plaquemines, and they're going to build a bigger base, which consumes, you know, let's say more, I'll just, for lack of a, just to make it easy, consumes more of that baseload Permian supply.
Yeah.
And so anything incrementally above that has to be met by more elastic sources of supply, like the Haynesville, which if the prices go up, Haynesville producers show up. If the prices go down, Haynesville producers, you know, slow down. And you know, so the bunch of other factors play into this that have changed in the space, capital discipline being one of them. Producers just aren't, you know, putting holes in the ground every single day without paying attention to cash flow. So they're very cognizant of cash flow and investors' needs, and that's changed the equation. We haven't built storage. So in the gas sector, you know, when a hurricane comes through and you've got, let's call it 20 BCF of LNG along the Gulf Coast that says, okay, we can't move boats out for a couple of days because there's a hurricane in the Gulf. We need somewhere to put the supply. Okay, well, we haven't built any storage in, you know, much storage. We built a couple. We haven't built much storage in a decade. Right. So where's that supply going to go? Well, it's going to go into the storage coffers, but those fill up really quick. And then the only thing you moderate supply and demand is price.
Right.
So therefore, that's what creates that volatile environment where, you know, we've got price. And in particular, we see that volatility in gas, at least this year, because, you know, producers have pulled up back as they should at a lower price. And so we're starting to take that high storage level where we're, you know, well above the 5-year average and start to drift down below the 5-year average. And that's where things get volatile. There's just less ability to respond to, you know, supply and demand fluctuations if there are some.
Right. So I want to kind of go back to talk a little bit about the Permian. A lot of our customers are in the Permian, and there's been a challenge with just, again, how much gas they're, when you look at the oil and gas ratio, there's a lot more, they're kind of diverging, right? Like oil's somewhere going down, you're getting more water, you're getting more gas. I often joke and say, you know, eventually we're going to be talking about associated oil production, not associated gas production, just because of the direction there. But how do you, like, when you look forward and you project, if the trend continues, how does that change? And obviously with the export capacity being brought online over the next 5 years from all these LNG export facilities, that's going to help. But is there enough infrastructure in place or planned for all that offtake to get to the Gulf Coast to export? I mean, can you just, like, on a macro, just kind of explain what's going on there?
Yeah. So from an infrastructure standpoint, on the, let's go back a little bit to sort of NGLs and gas at that GNP level, because we spend a lot of time in the, you know, in the field. And, you know, one of our base models, as I told you before, is talking about how do you build up from an asset level, every single asset. So we model and track every rig and connect it to every GNP system in every well to every GMP system. So we're trying to really model from a ground up what volumes go into which plants, what rigs are putting volumes into which plants. So we can then go downstream and say, okay, how much volume is going to, when we're doing a forecast, how much volume is going to feed these plants? How much volume is going to feed these pipelines? And do we have enough taking this? So that's part of the strict ground up analysis. And what you asked about with GMP in particular, if we take that as our first piece of infrastructure, we are building enough GMP. It matches our current forecast for the amount of growth in the Permian over the next few years. So, but it's an exact match, meaning we're building exactly as much GMP as we need through that. You know, GMP plants generally get announced about 18 months ahead of time. So we're right on track with the 18-month growth trend. Beyond that, obviously, if you can't carry the forecast forward, we don't have enough infrastructure there and not enough plant. But again, these are short timelines, lower capital intensive projects. You know, we're talking $200 million, something like that, to build a plant. It doesn't take a big commitment, nor, you know, moving heaven and earth to get it done, you know, through the regulatory bodies and whatnot. It's easier to get done. On the pipeline side, I talked about NGLs before. We got plenty of NGL capacity. For the gas coming out of the ground, we have proposed enough. We've got Matterhorn coming online in third quarter next year in 2024. So that's a big one that'll put gas into Katy, so all the way into your neck of the woods. Yep. And that's 2.5 BCF. So that's a big line. The other one that's out there that we think will get done, and we're sort of just waiting for confirmation from that, is there's a Saguaro LNG facility that's being built on the Baja Peninsula, and we're on the west side of Mexico. And that is going to be fed by a One Oak pipeline that'll take Permian gas west. So through Mexico Pacific Limited. And anyway, that should provide ample capacity for Permian gas to get out, which is good for Permian producers, right? You're not going to see basis disconnects or differentials that, you know, hurt the value of your molecules coming out of the ground from a gas perspective. Mm-hmm. So we have enough infrastructure and are planning enough to get it done. You know, the thing that holds the Permian back, and I appreciate your joke about, you know, an associated oil play, but the reality is oil still drives a lot of that. And yeah. So we, for two reasons, we see the backwardation of the curve continuing to trim rig counts in the future. So that's one area where we could be wrong. You know, like every year, is the curve really backwardated? I mean, I think there's this prevalent theme about, you know, sort of peak demand and death of oil and, you know, whatever. So it sort of drags the curve naturally that way. But the reality is we continue to hit, you know, higher production numbers out of the Permian, and the curve always sort of magically, you know, is higher than it, you know, looks in the forwards. Right. So, so that might be a bit of a underestimate of where the curve's going to be. The other thing that's driving that we're watching in the Permian, and we talk about this in the report, is that consolidation, you know, especially the public to private consolidation. There was a 70% reduction of rigs from private companies once they get consolidated into a public company. And this sort of makes sense with respect to aligning that fiscal discipline mentality, where a public company buys a private company, they cut the rigs to align them with their, you know, capital discipline protocol and what their plan is. And the reality is those publics really are trying to short long-term inventory, right? So it's to their benefit to cut a couple of rigs to make sure that they get the benefit of that long-term inventory analysis. So that's where we're, you know, from a Permian perspective, we feel good with where our forecast is, which has, overall Permian growth. I think we have it at, you know, between now and 2030, we added about 3.9 BCF of additional gas. And obviously, I think if the LA flat rig count, you know, that would go up. It would go up by several BCF. It would go, you know, 5 or 6 BCF. But that's where we're comfortable with it now because of the current consolidation and because of the backwardation of the curve. But that's, you know, that's where I say, let's tell a story and argue about the future, because it's a fair argument to say, well, the curve's not going to end up there. Peak demand is, you know, isn't happening, and everyone's wrong about the forward curve, and, you know, producers are going to continue to produce into it, and, you know, there'll be more efficiencies, and which is always something I get. It's always a nervousness. People are like, well, what's the total inventory look like? And I'm like, I don't know. Can you tell me what technology looks like in 5 years? And I'll tell you what total inventory looks like. That's, like, this stuff changes massively.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's one thing that I think people have underestimated, is just the amount of advancements in technology that's allowed us to extract more. I mean, again, I'm pretty close to a bunch of drilling completions engineers, and, you know, I was talking to a buddy of mine, who's on the business development side for a company who's pretty big in the Bakken, and they're going to drop rigs. But through completion technology, they're actually anticipating production growth. And so, you know, again, there's a lot of wild cards out there, and I know people are working tirelessly on completion technology. Drilling efficiencies have gotten to a point where, like, you're knocking Eagle Ford wells out in 6-7 days. Same thing with the Bakken. You know, a lot of the wells out in the Permian, like, drilling efficiency have gotten so much better. So you can, you know, you're able to, the amount of reservoir footage you're drilling doesn't require near the rig count. And so it's, you know, again, and like, how much more efficient can we get? I mean, each year you talk to folks like, oh man, there's not too much meat on the bone, but then all of a sudden they do some unique stuff with, whether it be just cycle times or offline operations or whatever the case is. But it's tough to sort of forecast that, but kind of tying it all together, and again, we didn't really even talk about crude and then other things. We're already blown almost an hour here, but I am curious. So on your guys' Dirty Little Secrets, you have at the end of 2024, natural gas, you're forecasting to be close to that $4 per MMBTU. And so just curious, coming, you know, it looks like the first part of the year is going to be slightly soft, goes down, and then towards the end of the year, it's going to pick up. And what's driving that increase, or what's putting the upward pressure on price for Henry Hub?
Yeah, our expectation is that we think that producers are going to produce into the, you know, Golden Pass and Plaquemines coming online. We need more supply to fill those facilities by the end of the year. So while there's softness at the front and tightening in the back, we're going to see some response to that. It's one of the key things. I mean, and you watch rigs, we're watching rigs too, right? Like, because it's like so key to see our rigs deployed in the front to start to drive some of that, you know, 4, 5, 6 month production out to feed those facilities. And, you know, otherwise, if you don't have that, you do start to run into an issue where you see price spikes that go, you know, way beyond our expectation of $4, because we don't have enough supply to feed those markets. And that's where we're watching that storage number two is critical of, you know, how close are we to that 5-year average, how far below, because the sort of indispensable baseload growth to the Permian, you know, again, producers are just going to do what they're going to do there. And the capital discipline mantra has meant that there's less, you know, elasticity of moving. They're not deploying rigs as quickly when oil goes up, you know, $5 or $10, right? They're sticking to their plan, and carrying out a more longer term, you know, I don't want to call it fiscally responsible, but they're capital discipline, right? It's like, let's make sure we have cash flow. Yeah. So that's where, you know, for us, we're looking this year at a dip. So production continues to, you know, sort of slide off. Rigs, we're going to watch for rigs as they start to re-enter, you know, the Haynesville area in preparation for feeding all that infrastructure we've added and still are adding down from the Haynesville in northern Louisiana and down to, you know, the Gulf Coast there. Because we've got 6 Bs of pipe either that have come online or going to come online within this year. And all that infrastructure is there to feed those facilities. And so filling those up, you know, we need the supply to do that.
And on that topic, from now till the end of the year, what is the increase in export capacity look like towards the end of the year? Like, I looked at it quite a while ago, but I forget. Do you recall?
Yeah, the total... you know, we've got Golden Pass and Plaquemines are the two facilities that are being added towards I mean, they're really late in 24, right? So we're talking, I think, I want to say like November, December, all 4Q. Plaquemines is, their first phase is somewhere around 2 BCF. And that Golden Pass facility is also around, I think, 2.5, 2.7 BCF. So that's, let's just call it 4 BCF of incremental demand that'll start to ramp up at that, at the very end of the year, and then, you know, trickle into 25. The interesting component of that will be, you put those two facilities online, 4 BCF, producers are producing, let's say, in to meet that, but it's not like, you know, there's a magic off switch at 4 BCF, right? Producers shouldn't, the curve just keeps going. And so that's where we're interested to see, you know, 25, 26, prior to, you know, significant new LNG capacity really entering the market. If that trend continues, then all of a sudden, now you're going to start to see downward pressure on prices again in that 25, 26 timeframe, before, you know, you really get the ramp of that second phase of LNG. Or you could see producers pull back a little bit, trim some rigs in the, you know, in the 25, you know, early 26 timeframe, waiting for some of that, you know, that with the expectation that LNG will show up. And we'll get a lot more clarity on that as we see, you know, LNG facility timelines, construction timelines, things like that.
Gotcha. Well, man, I could keep going here, but in the interest of time, we'll probably have to shut this thing down. I looked at the time and another 15 minutes has blown by, but man, it'd be cool to do a round two, maybe, you know, beginning of next year, and kind of recap this year and see what, if what we were thinking made sense, and kind of what you guys think into the following year. But man, this has been an absolute fascinating discussion. For folks that are listening and they're interested to hear more, where's the best place to find more information about East Daily and some of the stuff that you guys are putting out?
Yeah, go to our website. There is a ton of free stuff. You know, as Justin, as you said, like, Justin, I can't remember if you're on the free stuff, but you should get in hand. I think you are. There's a ton of free stuff out there. There's a daily note we put out. Again, it's really like we focus on really detailed stuff and then try to macro it up to what does it mean, you know, for whatever respect. So it's never just here's detail for detail's sake. It's detail for what does it mean. So there's that. We just launched a partnership with Hart on a, it's cool. It's a gas and midstream, report. They do it weekly. That's free. You should go check that out. There's a link to our blog. Love for people to sign up and join that community too.
Yeah.
I love, you know, you're building a community with this podcast. We're trying to do the same with some of our research. It's built just a community of people that really love this space, love the energy, love the transparency, which is what our company is focused on driving, is, you know, transparency through data. And love to have you guys join our community. There's a crew newsletter too that's free. So there's just all sorts of, I'm sure we'll launch one on NGLs here at some point in the not too distant future. So please come join the community. We'd love to have you. Learn about the space and ask questions, and love to come visit you. If you're in Houston or New York or Tulsa or Oklahoma City or all my favorite energy towns, we'd love to come visit you.
I love it, man. Well, this was a lot better than I expected. And so again, Justin, really appreciate your time. I knew it was going to be good, but I'm not this good, man. I didn't set the bar low.
I'm going to get a boring engineer and analyst on this phone. That's what you thought.
Hey, you said it, not me. You said it, not me. No, hey, but
I know the stereotypes, and I'm blonde, so you know.
No, I always go into it with an open mind. I always go into it with an open mind, but sometimes I'm like, hey, okay, let's see what kind of direction this is going to go. But man, it's been great to get to know you. I really hope to get to see you here in Houston when you guys roll down. I'll try my best to get in front of you. But for everyone out there listening, please connect with East Daily. Obviously, like, I have multiple newsletters coming through and just so much quality information that, again, I applaud you guys for giving a lot of this stuff out for free, because most of the stuff is behind a paywall nowadays. And I get it. Yeah. At the end of the day, it's a business, but clearly you guys are doing a lot of things right. And again, just appreciate all the content and education that you guys put out there. I'll put all the links in the show notes to all the stuff that we've talked about. And for everyone out there, let's always make sure that we're approaching the energy landscape with a radically open mind. Be kind and always remember that everyone deserves access to energy, and we is greater than me. Thanks, everybody.